Welcome, everyone, to a Baseball America podcast. Along with J.J. Cooper, I'm John Manuel. It's a somber day at the Baseball America offices because we realize that our official National Baseball Hall of Fame and Museum almanac that we compiled along with the National Baseball Hall of Fame and Museum last year does not need an update for the 2013 edition of the book. Last year's book, just as viable as this year's copy of the book. Go ahead and buy one
at
baseballamerica.com/store or by calling 800-845-2726, JJ, because nobody got in this
year. Selling short shrift on the – is there no Veterans Committee meeting this year?
Oh, wait, there was. There are three posthumous veterans. You're right. Well, that just changed the book, and I guess we have to change some photos.
That's probably not going to be a big selling new edition. Ooh, got to get some
– But maybe we'll put something in the front of the book on this year's vote, which, of course, thanks to Sean Foreman, the guys at baseballreference.com. I mean, I love – just having that right at the top of my baseballreference.com page today, because that's what matters in baseball today. And just amazing to me, JJ. I was prepared for it, but I'm still so surprised by the voting that not even any – and no one even got 70% of the vote. That blew me away. I guess I was prepared for the fact that no one was going to get in. But I guest lectured all morning over at Elon University, and then we had lunch with the professor that we guest lectured with, Nathan Rohde and I. It's his alma mater. So – I was out of the loop all morning and then drove back and heard about it, but I hadn't read anything until the last hour or so. And I'm still kind of surprised by the way that it went down. I guess the biggest surprise to me is that Kenny Lofton doesn't even stay on the ballot. That might be the worst part of all of it for me, is that not even worse than somebody not getting in is that guys like Kenny Lofton or before that, a Lou Whitaker, who don't even stay on the ballot for more than a year, is disappointing.
What stands out to me is that I do wonder if long-term this is going to be a significant year, because this is what leads to that when we look back, go, and that's when voting changed. Like, I think that there is a chance that this is going to mean that if we're talking 5 years from now, the Hall of Fame voting will be an entirely different animal.
That's very possible.
I can't imagine the Hall of Fame is very happy right now Hall of Fame weekend, Hall of Fame induction.
Build that week around Paul Hagen. Yeah.
There's nothing to build around this year. And if that happens because there's just no one qualified that year to make the Hall of Fame, well, that's one thing. No one can argue that right now.
Nobody can make that argument right now. That's for sure. I mean, I guess the other surprise to me is I really did think that at the very least that Craig Biggio would get in. Even though Barry Larkin didn't get in first ballot, even though Roberto Alomar didn't get in first ballot, and those are very similar players to Craig Biggio, do you think the Bill James calling him like arguably the best player of the 90s, or saying like in 1999 he was the best player, the fact that sabermetric analysis was higher on Craig Biggio than non-sabermetric analysis was, do you think that worked against him?
If it does, that's another example of when then the vote needs to change, because if you're a voter who goes, I'm not going to vote for that guy because some other people like him more than I do.
You really think that didn't happen?
Oh, I'm not saying it didn't. But
if it
did,
happens.
If it did, that's a problem. I mean, and I do think it probably, in some small cases happens, but that's just sad. Because it's one thing if you say, somehow I look at Craig Biggio and say, that guy's not a Hall of Famer. But I do not know, like I said, let's analyze Craig Biggio on the non, let's take the... if you're the absolutist who says, I'm not going to vote for anyone who played in the 90s because steroids were in the game. If you're not, let's take that out of it. Just say on the whether you're a sabermetric fan, and you believe that, on-base percentage and things like that are, in war do have value. Or let's say that you are, if it was past batting average, it's not for me. If that's the case, Craig Biggio makes it into your Hall of Fame.
Yeah, I just don't see how he doesn't make it into your Hall of Fame, period.
Gold glove second baseman, 3,000 hits.
I guess he still will. And I guess I'm just more of the opinion of you're either a Hall of Famer or you're not.
Well, right now, I'll say this. Next year, that's not true, because in the current rules, you can only vote for 10. So I can understand next year it being
something.
There
were more than 10 eligible good guys to vote for this year.
Next
year it gets worse, but it was a problem this year.
So I can understand right now you could say this guy's not a first ballot guy for me because I can only vote for 10. But when you're voting for one, as we saw, I'll put it this way. If you're voting for one guy and you voted for Jack Morris and no one else this year, I mean, beyond the idea that I'm just trying to stick my thumb in other people's eyes.
I don't think the thumb is the digit they're really
thinking
about.
Yeah, okay, yeah. I'm trying to be We have a clean tag on our podcast.
Well, so I didn't curse.
Yeah, I know, but I'm saying like, but short of that, I don't see. I'm baffled.
The Baseball Writers Association of America obviously is the gatekeepers of the Hall of Fame, and that is they're as good a group as any to be the gatekeepers of the Hall of Fame. I do think it's kind of silly that people like Bob Costas or Vin Scully or some of these longtime broadcasters.
Or Bill James, who wrote a book about the Hall of Fame and has spent years like.
Yeah, but he should actually just be in the Hall of Fame.
Right.
But
prominent baseball historians who basically, you know, who spend their lives studying baseball, I think should be part of the big.
Pete Palmer, those kind of
right.
guys.
Pete Palmer should be, yeah.
Sure, I'll buy that. But they're as good a gatekeeper as any. It probably would make more sense. The way that I guess I'll say a couple things here. First off, as we may have talked about in past podcasts, Baseball America members are not in the Baseball Writers Association. We've tried to be in the Baseball Writers Association one time. It was not well received in terms of I got no communication from the BBWAA about the application process. The only reason I interviewed with them, and I was interviewing on behalf of other BA staffers and myself, the only reason we even got there was that Dave Cameron of Fangraphs saw me in the hotel lobby and told me they were doing the interviews. I got no communication from the BBWAA. So my experience with them wasn't really positive. And then since then, 3 years, 4 years since then, basically our attitude at Baseball America has been, you know, I'm not sure we really want to be in the BBWAA. The only person in the office or in the company who really should be in my mind, for sure, slam dunk, is Jim Callis by their own rules because Jim works in a major league city. He's in Chicago. I guess I could make the argument for Aaron Fitt now. But one of the reasons they told us was we're all in North Carolina and you guys don't have a hard time getting credentials when you do go to games.
Which is true.
Which is true, yeah. But I mean, but most a lot of the people who have gotten credentialed don't go to games either. So I thought it was kind of silly. And then this off season, as I've been writing these columns about more major league stuff with the waiver wire rules and Mickey Story and getting kicked off the 40-man, I thought to myself, you know, I've written a lot of these articles now. I bet you I could get in. I talked to Lavelle Neal of the Star Tribune in Minneapolis, who's on the BBWAA board. After this, JJ, I'm just like, why would I want to be in this group when you're looking at these votes who are made public? And so many of the writers that I know and respect voted for like eight, nine, ten guys, like the Tracy Ringlesbys and Pete Abrahams and Jerry Krasniks. And even if they didn't vote for as many, I remember like Jim Capel voted for 10. So many of these guys who I know and respect and read, and then you see Murray Chass and Ken Gernick. I don't know them personally, but I have to do nothing but lose respect for you if the only person you voted for on this ballot is Jeff Morris. Jack Morris. How you can vote for Jack Morris and that's the only guy you vote for? I read Murray's attempt to elaborate on it, explain it, and it makes no sense. It was nonsensical. And it really does. To me, it's very hard to pick an organization that's done worse for itself in the information age than the Baseball Writers Association of America, because the more people learn about those membership, which still their Spink Award, still they gave it to Bill Conlon. They haven't taken that back. So Bill Conlon, who molested members of his own family, still gets their award, and they haven't rescinded it, and they can't let in these guys who they're suspicious of into the Hall of Fame. I know it's a little different, but it's kind of a joke.
No, I'm saying
that's pretty much a joke.
I'm looking at there's a couple of rationales that you can have to me. Logical, defensible rationales. Personally, to me, steroids were a big part of the game in the 90s and 2000s. Yes, absolutely. I'm voting Roger Clemens in. I'm voting Barry Bonds in. I'm evaluating Rafael Palmeiro on that. That's a little factor in it, but I'm evaluating him on is he good enough to make the Hall of Fame in general. I'm doing it that way. But I understand if you said
I do think Palmeiro is a little bit different. But because he actually did test positive, and the other players who tested, I actually heard Bob Costas talking about it today on MLB Network, and he said if you passed some kind of rule like they did with Pete Rose, and say, well, if you gambled on baseball and if you're suspended for gambling, you can't be in the Hall of Fame. If they had passed a rule that says if you're suspended for steroids and you can't get in, but that's not a rule right now.
I was gonna say, but to me, if you said. If you are a voter and you say that my rationale is that if you test positive or I even say, if you say that you have a voter that you say, or the vast preponderance of evidence, if you say, I know Barry Bonds didn't test positive.
He did. He was
but
convicted
he was,
in a court of law of obstructing right. justice into an investigation. Over
which,
whether
in which
or not
there
he,
was much testimony,
right.
in which his answer was, I didn't know I was taking performance-enhancing
right.
drugs, but clearly I was.
Right.
If that is your rationale, again, I may disagree with it. That, to me, is a logical rationale. You
right.
are, to
I
me,
agree.
To me, I will say this. It's illogical from one standpoint. Gaylord Perry is not in the Hall of Fame without cheating.
Completely agree.
And it was on the books.
Cheating is cheating.
It was on the books. If you were found when Joe Niekro threw, you know, oh, look, what did I find in my pocket? Suspended.
Completely
now,
agree.
You can say, well, that's within the bounds of the game. That's it's understood that there's some cheating that goes on. No, that's cheating.
I completely
this
agree.
This was cheating. But if you want to, again, if you want to say that that's your rationale, if you're saying if Gaylord Perry is on the ballot, I'm not going to vote for him.
So even if you leave Bonds and Clemens out, you're saying?
But if you do that, to me, to take that next step and say, well, this guy put up good numbers and he was pretty big and he was during this era, that to me, you've gone so far beyond having a rationale. Or if you say, I'm sorry, you played in the 90s and 2000s, so I can't
right.
vote for you because people were taking steroids at that time. How do you know, like, again, we were talking about this before we started the podcast. Bo Jackson, thankfully for his sake.
And our sake,
arrived in the early 80s. Bo Jackson.
Mid-80s.
Was, no, but Bo Jackson looked like Bo Jackson in 1982.
Yeah, but not, the country wasn't following him at all
no,
until
saying,
he
but,
won the Heisman.
But what I'm saying is if you saw him in 1982, though, and you saw Bo Jackson in 1985, not a whole lot of difference. I mean,
sure.
he was. So what I'm saying is that
you
track far enough back that you say that he was not tarred as a a steroid user. If Bo Jackson arrives in 1998,
right.
I don't care if he
no
passed every test ever given.
Yeah.
It would just be, there's no way that guy's not a steroid user. So what I'm saying is that you can tar, Mike Piazza is tarred as a steroid user by many people who voted in this without there ever being any evidence. Again, I'm not saying that it's even conclusively true that he didn't use.
Correct.
But there is no preponderance of evidence that he did. And I'm sorry, again, if you're arguing Mike Piazza is not a Hall of Famer based on what he did on the field.
That's an impossible argument. I mean, that's an impossible argument. I don't see how. That's the stuff those are the guys who really stun me the most. And I guess I'm just the most disappointed in the voters who act, who take that role of gatekeeper and I think just, apply it without a lot of logic. So it's just disappointing as a baseball fan. I'm talking as a baseball fan, not as a baseball writer in this regard, that I'm just really disappointed that if you don't want to vote for Bonds or Clemens, and they both got almost the exact same 36.2 and 37.6%.
Pretty much they got the, I will vote for you whether if you
yeah.
use steroids vote.
So there's 36% of the electorate basically that will do that, and maybe 1% that made a slight difference for Clemens and for Bonds. I just don't see... if you're not voting for them, how you don't vote for some of these other guys? And Jack Morris getting 67% of the vote is just one that I can't explain.
My argument for that is, I said this to Will earlier today when you were at Elon, I do feel like, and I don't want to denigrate because I'm sure there are some people who can try to make a pretty strong case for him, but I really feel like the best case for that is that if you're a voter who was in Minnesota at the Metrodome for Game 7 in 1991 – yes, I vote for him. And if you weren't, you don't. I mean, I don't want to go too far, but that almost is what it feels like. It's like his case, he was a very good pitcher.
It's really basically like you're giving him credit for being the last of the old school complete game guys. That's pretty much his case. He doesn't really have much of a case otherwise. I mean, if you want to give credit for that Game 7 in 1991, how about the Bloody Sock game? And how do you vote for him and not for Schilling? Schilling's career was clearly better. And in this era, Schilling was the complete game guy, the workhorse, the 220-inning-a-year guy, and he was demonstrably better. How many opening day starts?
And was more important to World Series champions than Morris.
He was the ace of three World Series teams and two champions. And one, I mean, I'm sorry, it is different. The Red Sox 04 is different because mm-hmm. of the Bloody Sock and because of 86 years and all that stuff. It's more significant than any the Tigers did. I mean, I'm sorry. It just is.
But more than anything, Curt Schilling demonstrably was a better pitcher
yeah.
than Jack Morris.
Demonstrably.
I mean, that's clearly that's not something that I don't think that there's an argument to be made.
It's cool for Curt Schilling that he got 38%. If you're not going to make it in, go ahead and get 38% if you're going to be a numerologist.
But it is not like, and if you want to say, well, you know, Jack Morris is a winner, then if you're saying that in this day and you base your entire around, if you're basing it all around that, then again, at this point, you either I do believe you're saying I just want to stick to these things because I do not want to engage in a discussion. And I know, look, I'm both sides. Twitter has been I love Twitter. Twitter last couple of days with this is like I was very happy to be chatting about the Reds at Baseball America during the announcement because I missed. Like, I'm sorry, I'll never get back to those days. I will not scroll back to what did I miss on Twitter between 2 and 3 o'clock. You know, and by the way, that brings up. On Twitter, if you follow us on Twitter, I'm JJCoop36. Apparently, I sometimes come across as that like I'm angry.
You can be a little testy.
And I'm not testy. I actually am talking with the voice I have right now. Usually, I'm actually pretty excited to be doing it.
JJ's happy-go-funky.
Yeah, I'm generally a happy-go-lucky guy. And so I apologize. If it comes across ever that I'm testy, I'm probably not testy. I'm probably sending that with a smile.
Well, who would you have voted for this year, JJ? Let's wrap this up with what would the JJ Cooper ballot have been? I can go first if you want me
to. Go first, because I got to bring up my little list of the eligible. So
I guess I'm adding it up. I only would have had 7 or 8 guys. I would have had Biggio. I would have had Bagwell, Piazza, Tim Raines. That's 4 for me. Schilling, Clemens, Bonds, and the only other. I think that's it for me. I think I would have voted for 7, and I'd be very much on the borderline with Edgar Martinez, Larry Walker, Fred McGriff, Sammy Sosa. I'm very much on the borderline with all those guys. But I think those were 7 definites. I would have felt absolutely no problem voting for those other 7 guys. And even Reigns is kind of borderline for me. I don't think it's so slam dunk. I don't even know if it's 100% slam dunk that Tim Raines' career is that much better than Kenny Lofton's, for example. I mean, I think it is. I think it's better, but I don't think it's that much better. I don't think it's 52% of the vote to 3.
I'll give you that. Especially because –
I mean, I think that Tim Raines' peak was a little better, but Tim Raines also didn't play center field. Right. I don't know how much of the defense difference, but I know from a scouting standpoint, finding a center fielder is a lot harder to do than finding a left fielder. And Tim Raines was always a left fielder. I mean, like, how often did he play the majority of his games in center field? Ever? Did he ever do that? I mean, 1984, it looks like he did that. And that's about it. I mean, I just don't.
And some of that was because they had other really, it's like, but some of it was not. I mean, like.
Yeah, I mean, Ricky Henderson, he pales in comparison to Ricky Henderson in a way, because he didn't have Ricky Henderson's power. But, I mean, I still don't think that I don't count that against him, but I'm just comparing him to Kenny Lofton. I do count it against him, because they were similar players. Raines had more power and was a better offensive player. But how much of that 16 points of OPS plus and the more power that Tim Raines had, how much of that is mitigated by the fact that Kenny Lofton played center field? I don't know. That's a tough question. And, his on-base percentage is 13 points better than Kenny Lofton's over the course of his career. Kenny Lofton played a little bit more offensive era, but I don't think there's that big of a difference between those two players. So I don't know that I would vote in Kenny Lofton on the first time, but he would have been in the discussion for me. He's a lot closer to Tim Raines, I think. I do think
part of what makes Kenny Lofton is a victim of the steroid era here as far as not being on the ballot, because what happened is that, again, you can only vote for 10 because we have the backlog of the Sammy Sosa's and Mark McGwire, and guys like that who have not gotten in, who normally would have cleared off the ballot.
Right.
If you are a guy who's willing to vote for those guys, that's part of the problem.
It is. I mean, Kenny Lofton actually led the majors in steals more often than Tim Raines did. I mean, I like Kenny Lofton. I think he was a little underrated player. I think the fact that he was a vagabond at the end of his career hurt him. But to me, he's just not that different from Tim Raines. Tim Raines is better, but not that much better. Not so much better that Kenny Lofton gets left off the ballot. All right, so I had 7 guys on my ballot.
Okay.
My theoretical ballot, JJ.
Let's see.
On your theoretical ballot?
Biggio, Bagwell. Piazza, I would have Raines, Schilling, Clemens, Bonds, McGwire, Sosa.
McGwire and Sosa to me, I don't think would have been Hall of Fame caliber players if not for their PED use.
See, and I'm saying I'm going on the approach of I'm going to take you on the numbers that you produced.
And even on what they produced, Mark McGwire's borderline. His career to me is so much like Dave Kingman's, only he didn't play in the 60s and 70s. He played in the 90s.
No, I mean, I can see the argument, but to me,
and Sammy Sosa, it's a very short peak. It's a ridiculous peak. And he didn't bring a whole lot else to the table. I just traded for him in our retro league. I mean, I'm looking forward to 2002 Sammy Sosa. And that's obviously past his peak, Sammy Sosa. But I still think I wouldn't have voted for him or McGwire.
No,
those are certainly defensible. I mean,
right.
Sosa hit 600-some home runs.
Right. Again, to me, my argument is that if I'm saying, you know what, because to me, like, if you're – I follow you. So your argument – again, to me, these are defensible. Your voting paradigm is – if you felt like a guy would not have made it in with, if the guy would have made it in without the steroids, like Barry Bonds used performance enhancing drugs, but clearly Skinny Barry would have been
Skinny
a Hall of Famer.
A Hall of Famer.
Giant Head Barry is the greatest player of all time.
Right.
But
that's right. And skinny Mark McGwire was still towering and still hit home runs, but he wasn't a Hall of Famer. And then he became Monster Mac and. That was just a little bit different to me. And you talk about a short peak. That guy had like two peaks, and they were both very short. There's massive valleys in between.
When you say that, but McGwire, when you say two short peaks, he was a 12-time All-Star. Now, I know that.
Yeah, I'm not going to use all. But like
but
87.
He was a 10-time MVP top 10 guy. So.
I guess 87 to 92 is a one peak,
and then,
96 to 2000 to 1999 is another peak.
Right.
I mean, 2000 he played 89 games.
Right.
I'm not
gonna
call that part of his peak.
No. But every
so
one of those
peaks.
Years, those two peaks though, are 10 years.
I guess so.
It's not like he went. We're not talking about Roger Maris hitting 61 and then you're going, okay, that was really nice.
But Roger Maris was a great player in other ways than 61 home runs. He hit 39 the year before and could have been MVP in 1960
right.
and was a very good player.
No, I'm saying, but his peak, though, was a.
Right, and he's not in the Hall of Fame.
I understand, but what I'm saying is that it's not to me. There is a difference in that Roger Maris's peak was basically about 3 to 4 years.
I guess if I'm dissecting McGwire, we're talking about his peak is 87, which is a home run crazy year. You're talking about an expansion era in 92, 93, and then also 93, but then also the expansion and steroid era in 98, 99. I guess I'm just thinking to me, most of his value is in home runs and walks. Well, not the most of.
No,
all his value.
All his value is home runs
and
walks.
I don't think that second peak happens without the PED. So for me, he's just too borderline, and then Sammy Sosa is a worse case than McGwire. I would vote for McGwire before I'd vote for Sosa. Even though tools-wise, Sosa should have been the more well-rounded player and the player who contributed more in more ways than just home runs and RBIs, but doesn't seem like that's actually the kind of player he was. And I have no problem not voting for Palmeiro. I mean,
I don't with Palmeiro in the era he was in. I don't think he was. The argument for him is that my argument for McGwire is if you said during those times, and again, if you want to say because it was because of steroids, that's fine. But if you said who was the best first baseman in the game. There was a time where the answer was Mark McGwire, and you wouldn't think a second to say it. I don't think that was true of Rafael Palmeiro.
That's true.
It was a great era for first baseman, but, to me, if you say with Rafael Palmeiro, you'd say, he's the fourth or fifth best.
So next year this just gets worse probably with
Greg
Maddux, Tom Glavin, and Frank Thomas coming on the ballot, plus all these guys are still on the ballot with the exception of Kenny Lofton. All these, I think, fairly deserving.
And I think that's players. Part of what's going to lead to changes. Like, there's been a lot of proposals out there. I mean, I do want to talk about this a little bit. Like
Aaron Seeley getting a vote today. Hoochie mama.
But
wow.
Jeff Cirillo didn't. I was a big Jeff Cirillo fan. Not for a Hall of Fame vote, but, it's nice to see him on the ballot.
Or Ryan Klesko. No Ryan Klesko votes. Joe Table. No Joe Table votes.
But
and by the way, I wish I could vote for Palmeiro. He had 64 home runs for my 2001 retro team.
He's in your retro league Hall of Fame.
Oh, well, I have him and Sosa now back to back. I'm just building a steroid monster team.
But I'll ask you. So if you said, okay, you can design a new system to determine who gets in the Hall of Fame, well, how would you change it?
Well, I think to me, if the baseball writers are going to have the vote and they're not going to give it up anytime soon, they have to limit it to people who are actually covering the sport or make some kind of means test. I think where they make sure guys are paying attention. I also think that the blank ballot, where you send it in and you don't vote for anybody, I don't approve of that as a. If you're voting for the Hall of Fame, vote for somebody. I don't think that should be an option.
Or don't turn in a ballot. That's fine.
Don't turn in a ballot, but don't vote for nobody and have it count as a zero and kill these guys' chances. I hate that as a protest vote. I hate the whole idea of the protest vote.
I would be interested to see if that kept BGO out of the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, I think it probably did. And then I would also find, like you said, have a committee of the active people who want to be involved in this to reach out to non-writers to give them votes. Like we talked about, the historians and those kind of things. There are rational steps I think you can take. But, again, to me, the reputation of the BBWAA is what has taken the hit over all these, less so than the Hall of Fame, because the Hall of Fame is so cool to go to. What has the BBWAA done that has endeared it to readers or customers over the last 10 years other than make bad picks and done things like this? And what have they done to embellish their reputation?
And I was going to say, and some of that is unfortunate, I think, because as we said, I mean, I think we should make clear, there are a lot of people that we know in the BBWA. There are a lot of people that we very strongly respect.
Well, like I said, and most of them voted with cool ballots, with smart ballots, and explained their votes with, I really agonized over this, and it's really not easy. All of them tell me,
And this
was not easy.
And I can respect people who have different rationales than mine on this.
Certainly.
I can understand. Some of the ballots, I'll be honest, I see them and I'm like, okay, but I don't understand what your rationale was. That's part of my problem is that you see some rationales and it's like, okay, that person says they're not voting for anyone who they thought used steroids. I don't agree with that rationale, but at least there's some consistency to see that. I really have a problem if you have the
– like, I don't know Bill Madden, but Bill Madden – and I usually don't agree with Bill Madden with what he writes. But he's covered the AIM for a long time in New York. That's not an easy job, not an easy thing to do. And he voted for BGO, McGriff, Morris, Schilling. There's some consistency there. He didn't vote for anybody with any steroids taint at all. I do think if you're going to be hard line on the steroid stuff, you vote for BGO and Schilling
because they're
from that era. And just ignoring everybody else in the ballot, their cases were strong cases.
And there's no evidence of any sort. There's not even really strong suspicion.
I think this seems like an anti-steroid ballot. He voted for McGriff. You know, I think McGriff was harmed by being a home run hitter in that era when everybody was hitting crazy home runs. He had 493 home runs. He was a really, really good player. There were times when you thought best first baseman in the game, and Fred McGriff came to mind, more so than Rafael Palmeiro. Yeah. So I could vote for McGriff. I can buy the McGriff vote. I don't buy the Morris vote. I think that's just kind of like I really do think that's a reactionary, like, wait a minute, he was better than Burt Blylove, and if we're voting in Blylove and we're voting in Morris, I think that's a reactionary vote. But I'm not going to damn him for it.
And to me, I'm sorry, but one of the things is that I thought, where Bill James' book many years ago now, The Politics of Glory, which I think was renamed when they reissued it.
Whatever happened to the Hall of Fame?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like Politics of Glory better, the title.
Me too. But, it's a great book.
But one of the things he pointed out is please, no one ever make the argument, so-and-so's in, so-and-so has to get in. Because if you do all of a sudden you're turning around and you're not just – it's not that Kenny Lofton's not making it about it. You're going, well, Kenny Lofton's easily in, and we're turning around and going, you know, Shane Victorino, he had a good career, and we got to get him in.
Joe Posnanski also had another solution that he posited, JJ, an inner circle Hall of Fame and then a different –
That was Bill James' idea, I think, originally.
I can start getting behind that, but I don't know that with as big and unwieldy as its membership is, I don't see the BBWA changing unless there's really strong leadership there. Susan Slusser and Lavelle Neal and those guys are in charge.
No, but here's
I don't
the thing.
Envy them.
It's not the Baseball Writers Association of America's Hall of Fame.
Right.
So,
the Hall of Fame is not going to change either, I don't think.
Well, I was going to say, but the Hall of Fame, though, if they want to,
they could.
They can change it tomorrow.
They could. I don't see them taking away, because who do you give it to?
No, but you also don't. But I'm saying you don't have to take it away. You can go to the BBWAA and say, we need to change some things.
That would take leadership as well. I don't know. That's what I don't know if that's how the Hall of Fame rolls, is making big changes. But I would imagine it would take several years of this, several years of summers in Coopertown where nobody comes.
I know that there's something to be said for vagueness, like to have a character clause, but don't really go further in explaining what it was. But really, more than anything else, it seems like at this point there needs to be almost like some direction given on here's how you should treat the PED era.
Yeah, they need some direction.
And the other thing is beyond everything else right now also is that the limit of 10 votes, that people vote for 10 seems to be, that's going to cause a bigger and bigger problem.
It is going to be tough. Man, it's amazing because just to look at some of these votes.
It worked fine when it wasn't something that there were, because right now the problem is that if you are a person who says, I'll vote for steroid, you know, people who were suspected of steroid use, then there are guys who may be higher on your ballots. That means some other guys are not going to get on. Well, so what you can end up happening is the problem as I see that could happen going forward is that you create this massive logjam where you have two disparate groups. You have the group who says, I'm going to vote for the best players regardless of suspicions of PED. And you have another group say, I'm not going to vote for anyone with suspicion of PED. And so what happens is that, okay, Greg Maddux gets in, but you're left with the Craig Biggio's, that there's guys who say, I'll vote for anyone with suspicions, and that Craig Biggio is up 11th on their ballot.
Right.
And then you have the group who say, I'm not voting for any one of these other guys. And so Biggio's 2 on their ballot, but he still ends up getting like 65% that way. And
maybe they have to weight their votes. Huh? Who knows how they're going to do it? But it does feel like something has to change, and nobody getting in could be the thing that motivates change. And the thing is, we did have writers like Jason Stark and Tim Kirkjian and everybody who looked at this and looked at the Hall of Fame looked toward it and said, like, boy, this is coming down the road. You know, Jason was the first guy I remember writing, this is coming, guys.
And let's just say,
and he was absolutely right.
Hall of Fame, not like the Hall of Fame hasn't had problems with voting before. I mean, again, Politics of Glory did a great job of spelling out how, like, there was a stretch there where the Veterans Committee was like, if you played on the 1930 Cardinals,
right, you're in.
Look, they hit 300. Yes, well, yes, the league batting average that year was 300.
And the BBWA certainly had that, like, hey, if you played in the Big Red Machine, you're in. Borderline guy, Big Red Machine, come on in, Tony Perez, you know? I mean,
right, it's not like that this is the first time that there's been voting controversy or things like that. I mean, again, we have a character clause. Ty Cobb, no problem with that.
Yeah, and the character clause, I'm not saying he should be in, but if the character clause keeps people out, like on the steroid thing, how does it not weigh in the favor of a guy like Dale Murphy?
Right.
Now, I actually think that argument has some merit. I wouldn't vote for Murphy, but I don't begrudge anybody who did vote for him.
Right, but that is, it's... But really what it comes down to right now is that something has to... This is not...
So I basically agree with Michael Wiener. I basically agree with Michael Wiener's statement from the Players Association.
The best way I can put it is that...
And we wish Michael Wiener the best in his comeback. I mean, his recovery. I shouldn't say comeback, but in his recuperating from cancer that he's battling right now. I mean, a story very well told by Jerry Krasick this offseason.
But the best way I can put it is that what is great about the Baseball Hall of Fame is that people care about the Baseball Hall of Fame more than any of the other major U.S. sports Hall of Fames. I mean, it's not even close.
It's not even close.
And that's great. But what we're having now is not great.
It's not great. JJ, we're going to shift gears to the National League Central. How much or how little do you think, on a scale, a 2080 scale, how much of my doppelganger is Bob Nutting, the Pirates owner? I can't remember if we've gone over this.
At least a 65 or 70.
I think so, too. That's bad for Bob Nutting. I'm sorry to hear. I'm sorry for you, Mr. Nutting. But jam-packed issue, our National League Central issue. Why don't we just start off with the top 10s? JJ, you wrote a blog post about Brett Jackson. He's the Cubs' number 5 prospect. He is the highest-ranked prospect in the Cubs system who did not join the organization in 2012. And, in fact, it looks like he's the only one who's been around a couple of years. Well, no. I stand corrected. Arizmendi Alcantara was signed in 2008.
Alcantara's first year, full year in full season ball this year. But
right.
Yeah, he has been around.
But Brett Jackson, a historically whiff-tastic major league debut, struck out in 49.5% of his at-bats. Despite all the strikeouts in AAA and in the big leagues, as Jim Callis points out, he still had a lot of extra base hits, a lot of stolen bases. But I take it, judging by your blog post, that you are not optimistic about Brett Jackson, and that if he became a successful major leaguer, he would be bucking some significant historical trends.
Yeah, I mean, for one, it was the second, since 1947, you know, since the modern era, really, it was the second most highest strikeout rate by a position player in 100 or more at-bats all time. Dave Duncan, 1964, the catcher with the A's.
And that's the same Dave Duncan that we know and love now.
But But more than that, so the blog post, you know, when I went back and looked at this, let's look at everyone who struck out in 40% or more of their at-bats in 100 more at-bats. And we didn't say as a rookie. We said at any point in their career.
Right.
And the thing that stood out is this. It wasn't that you couldn't find some successful players in that group, because you could. Dave Kingman, we just talked about. Dave Kingman was one of those guys.
Should have been a pitcher.
You can find Dave Kingman. You can find guys. Kelly Shopik has had a couple years that show up for that. Russ Branyan. But the thing that stands out is that almost without fail, the guys who had some success despite the strikeout rate like that are all big power guys, or they're glove first catchers who really, if you say, okay, we're willing to live with that because he's a backup catcher.
Right.
And that's what Kelly Shopik is. I mean, Kelly Shopik has pretty much for his career been a very solid platoon catcher. And you say we're going to pick spots to play him, things like that. If you look at Brett Jackson isn't a guy who's going to hit 40 home runs in a season. That's not what he does. He's got very good power for a center fielder, but it's kind of a Drew Stubbs type. Your hope is it's a Drew Stubbs type career.
That's what your hope is.
But the problem is that with that
with more power.
But I don't think he really. I mean, he doesn't have more raw power than Stubbs.
But his power has been more in evidence at the upper levels than it was for Drew Stubbs.
He's not
less
as good defensively.
Less defense.
He's not as good a runner. And the real concern for me, like, if you said, like, that, and so, but if you look at the list of guys who at one point were significant prospects who flamed out, there's a pretty good number of guys who were pretty significant, you know, reasonably significant prospects who failed. And really, when you look back on it, you say, well, why'd that guy fail? Well, he struck out too much.
Right. He did not make contact enough.
And that's, to me, like, it's not that Brett Jackson just said he struck out 50% of the time in the big leagues. He also struck out 38% of the time when he was in the PCL last year.
Yeah, and that was one of the harder ones where you were trying to find guys with 35% strikeout rate or higher in the PCL and who'd had success.
Our database for the minor league stuff is shorter. I mean, major leagues, we got all the major leagues. Minor league side, it goes back to, you know, we got pretty much everyone from 2006 on. And then we've got further guys. If you played in 2006, we got your minor league stats from before then, anywhere in baseball.
Okay.
So it's a smaller group, but, yeah, the success rate of those guys, it's a big difference when you talk about a guy who's striking out even 1 in 3 times at the plate and a guy who strikes out, you know, 35% of the time.
Yeah, 2 out of every 5 times. I mean, it's a big difference. That 30 to 40 is a big difference in the jump. And yet I still feel pretty good about the Cubs' top 10. Not great, but pretty good. Mainly because I like that their top three is so exciting. Javier Baez, Albert Almora, Jorge Soler. Just a very exciting trio of talent. And there are middle infielders in here, but with a pitching situation in this farm system is just hideous.
I'm putting the ball on a tee for you here because I know the answer to this before I even put it there. But, John, what do you think the chances that Aroides Vizcaíno, when we look back 5 years from now, you go, you know what, that guy's been a steady front end of the rotation starting pitcher.
Oh, that's not even where I thought you were going. So I'm very glad you didn't go in the other direction. But I think Aroides Vizcaíno is a bullpen guy, and I know the Cubs are going to try to make him a starter. And there is some argument. You know, John Smoltz thought that starting was easier. I just don't see how Aroides Vizcaíno's track record, where he had a stress fracture in his back or whatever it was, when he was in short season ball for the Yankees, repeated elbow and shoulder injuries, and now coming off Tommy John. I just don't see how this guy's going to hold up physically. And I've always actually liked the Aroides Vizcaíno as a guy.
Stuff-wise.
Yeah, but I mean, like, the track record of the injury track record is just pretty – it's Chris Snelling-like. You know, I think he's thrown more than 100 innings once in his life in professional baseball. So I thought you were going to ask me a question about the Cubs' farm director changes, and I will say at the ABCA, the American Baseball Coach Association convention, the question I was asked the most was, what do you think of the Cubs hiring Derek Johnson of Vanderbilt to be their new – be their new pitching coordinator, and that is the talk of college baseball at that convention. It's the talk of his peers, and people really want to know if this is going to start a trend. But the college coaches I talked to saw this as an acknowledgement that, okay, pro baseball said, college guys, maybe you do know what you're doing. Not all of you, but some of you do know what you're doing. And for a program like the Cubs, for a franchise like the Cubs, to turn to a college guy to help fix their pitching problems, that spoke volumes to the college coaches, and it was it's a sign of it kind of goes in with like what I've always said about Trevor Bauer, that a lot of the revolutionary and evolutionary and informed things that are happening on the pitching side of baseball, the innovation that's going on with pitchers is going on the amateur side. And that's who's innovating, not professional baseball. So
and
that's where that goes back to. You know, and the Cubs are
logical,
desperate enough to try
But
it.
You know what? There's some logic to that, too, in that at the amateur side, you can try out more things. Here's the argument I'm going to make. Okay. On the amateur side, there is a much broader segment. I mean, you're talking about – because on the amateur side, you're talking high school, you're talking college, you're talking showcases, you're talking pitching gurus, you're talking all that.
Right.
So,
but you're mostly talking the same kind of player. You're talking country club, white kids, basically.
I'm not talking player right now.
Okay.
I'm talking instructor.
Okay.
And what I'm saying is that, to the best way I can explain it, some of these guys out there are thought of as pretty unconventional by a lot. You know, Mike
yes.
Marshall is, you know, if you watch the Mike Marshall – you know, recommended delivery, it's unconventional to the extreme.
It hurts to watch.
Yes. It makes sense. You're going to see that in amateur. It makes sense that you're seeing that in amateur baseball because in amateur baseball, you can try – as I see it, the risk is less. Not that I'm saying there's more – not less. There may be a little less incentive too, but the risk of, okay, this didn't work – for a pitching guru, or
you're losing less money.
Right,
you have less invested.
You have less invested.
I buy that.
Whereas at the professional level, if a professional team said, "You know what, we're going all Marshall,"
that would be crazy.
Let's just say this: if you did that and you failed, I mean, it didn't work even for a year. You're all getting fired.
No doubt about that.
So you go from the risk in professional baseball is. I have a job that there are thousands of people who want my job. And for a year, I'm out of it, and I can't get another job like that. Whereas if you're an amateur, if you're a guy who studies pitching and all, the bar is that I need to find someone who's interested in doing what I want to spread.
I guess I follow
and
you
then
there.
If I fail, if people see this as a failure, I go back to doing what I was doing before, which is not involved in, you know, like. The bar is so much lower to me, so it makes some sense to me. There's innovation.
That makes a little
there.
Sense. Explaining it that way makes a little bit more sense to me.
As the ideas are proven, they kind of percolate up to a point where some team goes, "Who is in need
right.
of?" It goes, "You know what? There's some validity to this. We basically had a chance to sort out some of the
right.
crappy ideas, and we're going to go with this."
The parallel I was going to make is, spread option, that read option offense will never work in the NFL. And it worked so well in college, and those quarterbacks were so good at it in college, they made themselves into first-round picks. And then an NFL team decided, well, this is why we drafted him, so we're going to let him do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which is, in baseball, someone would have taken RG3, Robert Griffin III, out of Baylor, the Redskins quarterback, if you don't follow it at all. And they would have said, oh, no, we're going to make you a drop-back pocket passer. The NFL used to do that,
mm-hmm.
but they don't do that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But that is the equivalent to Major League Baseball taking a guy – Say if they'd taken Trevor Bauer and said, no, we're going to give you a conventional delivery and a conventional throwing program. Oh, wait, no, that's the Royals and Mike Montgomery. So off the soapbox. But that is what this is kind of akin to. So I think baseball is a little slow to the party in acknowledging that there's innovation at the amateur level. But I think this will be a good trend going forward.
You know, I think it was a big step for that. I think if you look back on it, there's a lot of people you can point to it all. But I think Tin Lipscomb was
I don't disagree.
Was to me in many ways, if you look back, if you're writing a history of this, which
he could
would
be
love,
the guy.
We, both of us would love to
he
do.
He could be the guy though who changed attitudes.
Because the problem with Lincecum was that he was not conventional.
Right.
He was small. I mean, you know, you see him.
Yep.
He's small.
He still is small. He still is unconventional.
He has a delivery that is not like something that you were I mean, that is no one will ever say with Tim Lincecum, you know, that's a cookie cutter delivery.
Right, exactly.
And he believed in it. And there were teams were like, I can't believe it. Yeah, he might be a okay reliever.
Right.
And then he goes out, and yes, we may see that the peak was
He may
pretty,
be done.
He may be done. But you know what? If he was done, the Giants got is still probably the best pick in that draft.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
you know,
I'm with you.
And that's the thing.
Evan Longoria is the only guy standing in the way.
Right.
Win a championship.
Right. But the thing about it is that if you considering where the Giants picked.
Oh, yeah, 10th. Yeah, no doubt.
That to me, he's the best pick in that draft. And if you get a couple of Cy Youngs out of it, and I think that led to teams going, you know what? We got to realize that being unconventional is okay.
You might be right about that, JJ. I hadn't thought about it that way, and that's a great take. I love that take.
Tim Lincecum was the guy who pretty much a year before, I mean, he was sophomore eligible.
Yeah, 41st round.
$1 million.
Still was offered $1 million, was offered, I think, $850 by the Indians.
And so I really think, though, that he was the guy who paves the way that when a guy like Trevor Bauer comes out, who bigger than Lincecum, but similar unconventional delivery.
And also similarly unphysical. Tall, but not physical.
Not physical.
So a guy where you say, boy, this crazy workouts that he does, he's going to wear down under that. Maybe Lincecum did eventually, but when he held up under it, he was outrageous.
And again, I think there's also some realization now. Like, I think the Giants did a good job with that. And, like, he didn't spend a long time in the minors.
Right.
If you said, you know what, this might not work for 5 years, but we're going to get 4 good ones out of it, well, use the 4 good ones.
That's what they did. JJ, I'm going to skip the Reds. We're going to come back to the Reds. Milwaukee Brewers, top 10. Not the most exciting top 10 in the Baseball America handbook or in this issue. Victor Roach and Georgia State still using hats that – it's like he got
– Georgia Southern.
Georgia Southern. What did I say? Georgia State?
Georgia
I'm sorry.
State's Atlanta. Georgia
I'm
Southern
sorry.
Is Statesboro.
Yes, I apologize to Georgia Southern.
As the Georgia boy of the office, I will.
I'm aware. I like Southern Georgia guys. I can't believe I just made that mistake. But Georgia Southern is like – is that the hat that Joey Hamilton used to use? I mean, that logo has not changed.
No, that's,
come on. Come on,
Rodney Hinnon. Not just Joey
Rodney
Hamilton,
Hinnon.
But power hitter.
The catcher. No, that's
it was
Steve,
an outfielder turned the catcher.
It wasn't
yeah.
Steve Hacker, was it?
No.
No, Todd Green.
Todd Green.
That's it.
Todd Green.
Todd Green, outstanding.
Saw Todd Green play in college. So.
But it's not a horrible top 10, but it's not a good top 10 when your number one prospect had a 4.66 ERA in AAA the year before. But – at the same time, JJ, I will say on our pitching tip, the Brewers were an organization that for a long time I used to lump in as one of the worst because outside of the Ben Sheets and Yovani Gallardo, they didn't develop a pitcher for a decade. But now, as our Tom Hodricourt astutely points out, they're looking toward 2013 with almost an all homegrown rotation because Willie Peralta's got a shot at that rotation.
Mm-hmm.
And Taylor Youngman could come on down the line. And Tyler Thornburg got a shout out this year's rotation. Mike Fears was in last year's rotation. Flamed out at the end, but probably will be again in 2013.
I'll put it this way. There's no reason that you're not going to give Mike Fears a chance to prove that he's turned back into a pumpkin.
Even Mark Rogers has a shot at this 2013 rotation. I was presumptuous on
Although,
Youngman.
Fairness with Mark Rogers to say that if we're going to say with Aroides Vizcaíno, what are the chances that he'll be healthy starting pitcher?
Oh, yeah.
You
got to
say the same thing with
Mark
Rogers.
Yeah. I would say that his track record, injury track record, is worse.
I mean,
he also has
high school pitchers. There are high school pitchers drafted the same year as him who I think are getting ready for free agency, and he's breaking.
Yeah, Phil Hughes is same draft class, 2004, if I'm not mistaken. Phil Hughes and Mark Rogers and Homer Bailey, the three big high school right-handers in that draft, if memory serves.
The rest of them are arbitration eligible, at least. I'll put it that way.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a long time coming for Mark Rogers. He's got one of the longer stat lines in the book.
I hope for his sake that he's not in the 2014 prospect handbook, but if he is, it would start to put him in the case of the most prospect handbook appearances.
He'd have to get hurt again and again because he's at 49 innings. So
yeah.
He just made it in by the skin of his teeth.
I think Adam Miller's record is still safe.
Into this year's. But yeah, I mean, high school picks in that 2004 draft, you had Mark Rogers, 5th overall, Homer Bailey, 7th overall. And, I mean, other high school pitchers, Scott Elbert, who was a left-hander. I mean, is Scott Elbert still around? I'm not sure whatever happened to him. And then Phil Hughes down there at 23. So Kyle Waldrop, 24, minor league free agent this offseason. That's it. Those are your high school pitchers in the first round. So if Mark Rogers eventually settles in, that'll end up being okay.
One of the best high school pitchers in the first round that year.
9 years later, it's hard to believe. But I take it, JJ, you're not too enthusiastic about the Brewers top 10.
No.
Would have looked better if John Segura were still there and still eligible.
Again, I don't want to harp on this too much, but it looked better if Taylor Youngman and Jed Bradley were better in 2012.
Jed Bradley not even in the top 10. Taylor Youngman 3, Jed Bradley not even receiving votes.
You know, and that's – I think really if you get past you get past number 2 and there's questions on everyone.
It's really tough to evaluate also Willie Peralta just on, like, you know, the September or the rest of it. You know,
right. I mean, there's no one. There's no one in that – everyone in that top 10. With Peralta, it's like, okay, we saw flashes, but, man, what was the problem for a while there? With Tyler Thurnberg, it's like, okay, is he going to be a starter?
Right.
With Taylor Youngman, it's like, okay, you know, I mean, he was pretty bad at times last year in the FSL in his debut.
Right.
Is Hunter Morris going to be a regular, or is he going to be one of those guys who go, you know what, it's just not enough there to be a...
Taylor Youngman pitched like a twin. I mean, 99 strikeouts on 153 innings. Durable, but not many strikeouts.
And you can keep going down the list.
Hunter
Morris. Jimmy Nelson is like, okay, is Jimmy Nelson reliever? Johnny
Elwig.
I think you like Jimmy
Nelson more than most. I liked him out of college. I still like him. I'm not sure if I think he has quite the ceiling that you do, but he had a better year than any of these other pitchers.
Johnny Helwig is great ceiling, but at the same time, I mean, it's consistency, it's command, all that. Victor Roach, can he come back from a pretty bad injury? Scooter Jeanette, is he a role player? Is he going to be an everyday? You can just keep going like this. I mean, that's...
Yeah, there's no perfect prospect in that organization. The Pirates' top 10, JJ, on the other hand, is one of the better top 10s in the whole book. But, I mean, to me, it's a great top 5, and then you really start raising some question marks. And
it drops off. I mean, there's a top 5, then there's a cliff.
There is a cliff.
And there's a plateau, because Josh Bell is sitting there in a lower level where you go, if he shows he's healthy.
Yeah.
But that's a big, when we're talking, the Aroldis Vizcaíno, Mark Rogers. Not the same, but you can lump a little bit of Josh Bell in there. When you're having platelets, you know, transfusion to speed the healing in your knee, that's
not
healed.
And it's the same knee that you hurt when you were a high school junior. And
you're not ready, you know. At this point in his recovery, Adrian Peterson was at 2,000 yards, is the best way to put it. You know, and Josh Bell is not, it does not seem like he's ready yet to play. I mean, right now, if you said, is Josh Bell going to be ready for the start of the season? The question is, I don't know if he's going to be. And that's a concern. After that, it drops off to another group of guys who probably are more predominantly are more role player type guys than future big leaguers.
Yes. Justin Wilson has one of the odder big league debut lines ever. 4 innings, 10 hits, but the 193 ERA and the opposing batting average of .455. Those two things don't square. But the top 5 in this top 10, Garrett Cole, I would say best stuff in the minors.
Oh, yeah.
He has the best stuff in the minors. Still figuring out how to get all the outs when he needs them with that stuff.
The 2010 scouting report still applies.
That's
Sometimes he does not look as dominant as you expect.
He's better than he used to be, but he's still evolving. Jameson Taillon, I think we're all pretty high on Jameson Taillon in here. Wouldn't say that we had ahead of Bryce Harper and Manny Machado on our draft board, as the Pirates said that year, but
he's still,
let's not hold that against Jameson Taillon.
He's a very good...
He's a really good pitching prospect. Luis Heredia, exciting. You'd like to maybe see some more strikeouts, but, you know, he's 18. He's pretty interesting. He's the kind of guy that Baseball America is all about.
Right.
You know?
So, got some projection there.
Right. Gregory Polanco and Alan Hansen.
I love these
guys.
I love Gregory Polanco. I'm
going to have to bring a towel in to wipe up the drool.
Just Gregory Polanco, to me, if you are talking about a guy who – he's not underrated at this point because everyone knows about him, but – He has all the tools you are looking for in a young outfield prospect, in that he has an idea of the strike zone. He has power potential. He has speed. He runs like a gazelle. He can play center. He has a great arm. I mean, it's all there. It's just development. It's just, can he keep improving as he moves up the ladder?
And Alan Hansen might have as much or more offensive upside. I think we just don't know where he's going to play defensively.
Right.
There's a little bit more unknown.
And I do think Polanco long-term is going to have more power. I've had guys who, you know, saw both of them in the Salad League say, I think Hansen down the road is a great top-of-the-order hitter. I think Polanco, you could bat 2, 3, 4, 5, or 6.
Yeah, I like both those guys. So we like that top 5. There is some depth in the Pirates organization, but it's still not great. And you're still, I think, they're still paying for – the 2009 draft, where none of those guys worked out for them at all. And then in 2010, when they got Tyone, which was the year where they drafted all the high school right-handers in a row?
I think that was
2009 or was that 2010?
They drafted a lot in 9, and that 9 draft is the one that really – there were a couple of years there. I mean, really, if you want to – the knock on the Pirates in the draft is that they've spent a whole lot of money on high school guys who've done nothing and who at the time, some of them was like, why are they giving that guy that much money?
Yes.
And that was the concern is that you can argue you're spreading your risk over a larger group, but some of the guys that were spreading their risk over a lot, you know, they haven't gotten payoff from that. And some of the guys, there were.
2009 is a draft that really hasn't turned out for them. The Tony Sanchez, Victor Black, Brooks Pounders, Zach Von Rosenberg, Colton Kane, Jeff Inman, all a lot of guys who got a lot of money. It was 2010, though, was the Tyone draft, where they basically took pretty much nothing but high school right-handers. Tyone, Stetson Alley, oh, disaster, thy name is Stetson Alley. Mel Rojas, position player, then right-handed pitchers from round 4 through round 10. A couple of those were college guys, but and then again, high school right-handers in rounds, or young right-handers in rounds 12 and 14. So just pitchers all the way through the first 15 rounds with three exceptions. So just not a it was a very unusual approach to the draft and not one that's worked out.
Moving on to
a different way to do a draft.
Of farm systems right now, like I think
they are the gold standard of farm systems right now, and that's the St. Louis Cardinals. And honestly, I couldn't imagine this when I first started Baseball America because they were always the bottom of our farm system rankings. And now, if they're not number one, they're number two or number three.
And I think I
think they're going to be number one. I know they were my number one.
They were my number one.
And they were Jim Callis's number one, so they're going to be number one. But JJ, the only like discordant note in this whole top 10 is, do you believe in Matt Adams as an everyday regular or not? And then Tyrell Jenkins really didn't take a real step forward last year. But the rest of those guys,
you know,
it's pretty hard to knock.
And the thing about it is when you're talking about that, we're saying like Tyrell Jenkins didn't take a step forward. He's the number 8 prospect
right,
on this list.
Right.
I'm fine with having him. That's a really good number 8 because you say, you know what? If he puts it together,
yeah,
he could
clicks,
be really interesting.
He's an athletic
but
pitcher
if he
with
doesn't,
a big arm.
It's okay. He's our number 8 prospect.
I mean, Trevor Rosenthal's 4. I mean – I don't think he's just a reliever, although I guess I do wonder if that's the role that he winds up in.
Right,
and that's
but
why
he could do more than that.
He certainly could do more than that. I think but if he's a reliever, he's an impact closer.
Michael Wacha at 6. That's I'll put it this way. We were just talking about the Brewers. Would you rather have Michael Wacha or Taylor Youngman?
I'd rather have Michael Wacha than Willie Peralta.
Yeah, okay, that puts
so,
it, yeah.
Yeah, I would have put Michael Wacha 1 on that top 10.
So,
there's no doubt. I don't know if I would take Colton Wong over.
I was
going to
say, I might put Michael Wacha on my personal Ricardo's top, would be number 5 ahead of.
But I might. But I think I could argue any of those top 6 players, number 1 on the.
And by the way,
Brewers
Oscar
list.
Severus, is there. The best way I can put it is this. Is there a safer prospect? I know we love to talk about Christian Yelich being a safe prospect. I think Oscar Severus is the safest prospect in the minors as far as. If you ask me if he's going to hit, barring injury, I would be shocked if he doesn't hit.
You're probably right. I mean, like, it's hard to envision anybody talking to any scouts about him and then watching the video and then reading the reports.
Seeing him at the Futures game, and it's like he put on a BP where you're like, oh, wow, look at that power to go with. You know he's got bat-to-ball skills. You know all that. Oh, no, yeah, by the way, I've got massive power in here too.
And, by the way, all his teams win.
Right.
I love that about Oscar Taveras. They win, and he's the best player on those teams. They win in large part because Oscar Taveras is such a dominant offensive player. But I like that his teams win with him.
Also impressed with this because you trust – like the Cardinals are a good – organization at this point, obviously. I mean,
yes.
There's no doubt about that.
Over
there was
points.
Questions. There were questions with him after his 2011 season.
Right.
Focus.
Defense. Exactly.
Cardinals,
commitment.
All that. The Cardinals sent him to AA to start the year. And they did that because they had seen an improvement in those things that they had talked to him about it. But to me, the fact that the Cardinals were willing to send him to AA, where he didn't just get to AA and go, okay, I'm okay here,
yeah.
Where he was basically one of the best players in the league, that stands out to me because that just is a sign they knew what they had there, that this guy, no, yeah, he was young. He's figuring that out. But they didn't worry. If they had sent him to high A, you know, because we've got to drill into him that he's got to pay more attention, he showed in 2012. Those concerns to me are largely put aside.
I agree.
Because
he put those to rest.
He jumped to another level. He started playing center field, a tougher position as far as, you know, what they asked for you defensively.
Yeah.
And he did everything they asked.
And he destroyed the baseball.
He's just the baseball.
He's the best hitter in the minor leagues. Not the best position player prospect. I'd still take Profar.
I agree, too.
He's the best hitter. But he's the best hitter in the minor leagues. So, Cardinals farms, I mean, Shelby Miller, best number two in the book. I mean,
if he's not, it's going to be really close.
I think I had him in my top 10 on my personal prospect list. And, I mean, I don't think I had two from any other organization. Not that I can think of.
He probably is the best number two in the
– And Shelby Miller figured things out pretty well by the end of last year, so – Pretty much an embarrassment of riches for the Cardinals. Last but not least, JJ, the Cincinnati Reds, your organization, as far as one of the two that you write up in the handbook and in the top 10. Organization of the year. It's a little bit of a lower period in Reds talent than it's been in the last couple of years, but it's for a good reason. They graduated talent to the big leagues. They traded talent for big leaguers. And yet, I still like their top four prospects. Their top four is in a league with any organization's top four. It's maybe not as good as, but I don't think any organization.
Those are four top 100 guys. And
that's it. No organization would be embarrassed by this being their top four prospects.
And when you say top 100 guys, those guys, I mean.
Those are like top 75 guys for me.
Right.
I don't think any of them are just scraping in either. And Billy Hamilton obviously had as good a year as anybody in the minor leagues had. He also did a lot for his prospect status last year, not just stealing the bases, but going to the fall league and being a center fielder, showing a little bit more thump, continuing his offensive performance,
going to double A.
Absolutely.
The key part of that to me is putting those numbers up in Bakersfield gets you throw in the, well, it's the Cal
right.
League.
But the walk-strikeout ratio he had in double A, controlled the strike zone. All he has to do is show enough juice to be respected. All he's got to do is have a little more power than Juan Pierre. That's basically all we're talking about. This guy's going to be a better version of Juan Pierre. Guess what? Juan Pierre wound up having a pretty doggone good career. Better version of Juan Pierre is Kenny Lofton.
But the big difference is that long-term, you know, right now he's still got things to work on in center field. The key thing is that a lot of these guys, you're talking about left fielders.
Right.
I don't talk to a lot of people who've seen Billy Hamilton who don't think that he's going to be a very good center fielder.
Better long-term career, Kenny Lofton or Billy Hamilton? Will he have a better career than Kenny Lofton? Which means, is he going to be – I'm not even putting him to that Hall of Fame standard.
I'll say Kenny Lofton because
– Really?
Yeah, and here's where I'll say this. I'm a conservative gambler by my – You're giving me money in the bank. You're giving me a guy who we both agree should be on a Hall of Fame ballot for multiple years. You're telling me that for a guy.
That was a .372 on base, I think, and a .423 career.
If you tell me that and you offer me that, or you offer me a guy who's yet to play in the big leagues, short of Mike Trout, Bryce Harper.
Yeah, but you work for us. So.
No, I know. But and I'm sorry if it's, you know, am I being a killjoy. But, yeah, I'm going to take that guy. But. If you say, could Billy Hamilton be better than that? Sure, I think he could. The thing that Billy Hamilton can do better than anyone we've seen, at least in the last 20 years, is steal bases. And I have no concern about saying that.
Right.
I'm not saying that there has not been a guy out there who runs a faster 60 than him. But I am saying, when it comes to stealing bases, and to me the thing that stands out with him beyond everything else is that, and look, he'll get, you know, hurt next year, watch or something. I'm jinxing it.
Right.
But he doesn't get hurt.
He doesn't get
hurt. Base runners who steal 100 bases usually are thoroughbreds who basically, like, you step on a hole wrong and they're going to miss 3 weeks with a tight hammy. He doesn't miss games.
I mean, 299, 372, 423, Kenny Lofton, that's his career line. I think that's a reasonable thing to expect out of Billy Hamilton.
That's
the 423, the power would be.
Yeah, I was going to say that 423 might be a little bit more because I think Kenny Lofton was a little more physical.
You know, in
Billy Hamilton has the skinniest ankles that you'll see.
In 94, Kenny Lofton had a .536 slugging percentage in the strike season. And then I think
Billy Hamilton will never have it.
Right. After that, he never slugged more than, I think, .458. I just was looking at it. And he had one other year very late in his career was .450. I don't think Billy Hamilton will have very many years where he approaches a .450 slugging. So he might just be on the shy side of a Kenny Lofton-type career.
But the thing he could have better is that, again, a little bit more steals and maybe even better defense.
I think he might even hit for a similar or higher average than .299 because he adds a platoon advantage, and I think that'll help him.
And the thing with Billy Hamilton, because the best way I can describe this is that I heard this back when he was struggling in the Midwest League. I had someone say to me, it's like, I'm not putting any limits on this guy because his athleticism is so impressive that when you see him and you see him a month later, he's light years beyond where he was a month ago. And that is held true for the last 3 years.
And the Reds
every
don't
year
have,
he's better that's than right. he was.
The Reds don't have this reputation like a Cardinals organization doesn't, or when they had George Kissel, the late George Kissel, and like some of these other, or like we've talked about, like with the Giants and their pitcher development, or some other organizations, the Rangers, the way Rangers guys get better. But the Reds deserve a lot of credit because Billy Hamilton has been handled well. He's been handled smartly. He's gotten better every year. Oh. Hamilton deserves that credit, but let's give their instructors
credit. And
let's give
credit also
too.
Credit, like just as we wrote in our Order of the Year story with them, they haven't had a first round pick flame out in a long time.
Yeah, it's kind of funny that the old success that you used to see with the Blue Jays is now kind of transferred over to the Reds as far as all their first-round picks click. JJ, we had a little debate, you and I, and then we'll wrap this up. Dan Langfield versus Nick Travieso. I like those both those guys, but I think all those guys from 5 to 10, all their BA grades are pretty much the
from
same.
From 5 to 20 in the Reds list. I mean, if you wanted to argue, I wouldn't argue number 20 over number 5.
Right.
But there's not a it's really not a whole lot of separation. And that's, like, I had someone point out to me today, said, you know, if you read the scouting report for Guillon and Cingrani, they don't seem a whole lot different. Cingrani's better.
Right.
There is some truth to that, though. They're both fastball changeup guys who you're really looking about the breaking ball.
Right. Cingrani hasn't had to be snuck through the Rule 5 because of an injury.
Velo, you know, wise, it's pretty similar, all that. You know, I think Dan Langfield a year from now, if you said, who are the two guys in this top 10 in the 5 to 10 range who a year from now we could be saying, yeah, that guy's a top 100 guy. You know, really, Langfield's one of those guys who could. Langfield a year from now could have had the Cingrani year from last year.
Right.
Really what we need to see from him right now. Scouting reports predominantly going into the draft were deliveries such that you're not really confident he's going to be a starter.
Right.
Smoothed it out a little bit. We got to see. Okay, show me that over a full season. Show me in start 25 of the season that you're still, you know, repeating things like that. And then the other guy, Jonathan Reynoso at 9, who it's because the tools are special tools.
He's the he's the lottery ticket in this
top 10. That was the chat today. It's like, you know, is he a lottery ticket? Yep, he's the Powerball lottery ticket. Andrew Brackman in the chat explained what Andrew Brackman is now, the $3 scratcher that you get, you know, down at the gas station.
Oh, Andrew Brackman. How did that come up?
Because Andrew Brackman's in the Red Sox.
I know, but I mean, someone asked but this me, is said, a prospect is
he
chat.
Said, no, he said, does Andrew Brackman have a chance? And I said, we'd already talked about like that. Yes, actually, I said Amir Garrett is a Powerball, you know, big Powerball jackpot lottery ticket. And then
I watched a little bit of the Cincinnati St. John's basketball game last week just to watch Amir Garrett play basketball. He didn't look so bad. He's probably a better prospect than baseball.
He's averaging 7.5 points, 5.5 rebounds a game. That's good.
I will say that we all used to think the same thing about Russell Wilson. But Amir Garrett is probably not Russell Wilson. Russell Wilson is pretty much the only Russell Wilson.
The thing that's working for baseball for Amir Garrett is that 6'6" lefties who throw 95.
Yeah.
Very small group.
Yes.
6'6" wings who can play defense, shoot a little bit, rebound.
But don't shoot threes. Yeah.
That's a very large subset of
those guys in the NBA
draft prospect
potential
right. group.
You want to go? I would think I would actually rather take my chance riding buses in the minor leagues than flying around Eurobasket if I was playing for, say, CSKA Moscow. I know they get paid more at CSKA Moscow, but it's a shady travel over there.
But the great thing for Amir Garrett is that you keep playing this basketball a little while longer because at some point you figure that the Reds may come to you and say, you know what? Let's give you a little bit extra inducement to give up that, you know, that basketball for good. I mean,
absolutely. Part of me wishes
you get more. I hate to say this to be crass, but you get more money if you end up deciding to give up base basketball before you're done with it, or at the draft time instead of waiting until you have, you know, eliminated that option.
The fact that he hadn't played much high school baseball at all worked against him in all these cases. But I'm looking forward to Amir Garrett being a full time baseball player. JJ, that was a lengthy podcast. I hope everybody enjoyed it. I hope we didn't bore you with the Hall of Fame stuff.
But I don't think so.
It seemed like it had to be done. So
it had
I know
to
it's
done.
Not our usual field of expertise, but we are a baseball podcast, and that was definitely the news in baseball today. So we'll be back next week. And I apologize, by the way, that between Aaron Fitt and myself, we did not wind up doing a college podcast from the ABCA convention. So working on the college preview issue right now. So apologize again for that, for not doing it, for promising that podcast and not delivering. Oh, my goodness. Jonathan Singleton suspended for 50 games for marijuana use is the tweet. That's not good news for the Houston Astros or for Jonathan Singleton. So that would have been a National League Central top 10 a year ago. No longer. I still think Jonathan Singleton's an elite prospect, but that certainly doesn't help his case for making the Astros in 2013. For J.J. Cooper, I'm John Manuel. We'll talk Jonathan Singleton and more, I'm sure, on the next Baseball America podcast. So long, everybody.